On November 9th, 2 days after Joe Biden was declared the winner of the 2020 presidential election, Kelly Meggs commented on a Facebook post. He wrote, quote, "A lot of people here are talking. I don't see anybody doing." He goes on, quote, "This fight is face to face, not far away. If you're ready to really join the fight, DM me," end quote. Kelly Meggs is the Florida leader of the paramilitary group the Oath Keepers, according to federal prosecutors. Just this week, the Justice Department released private messages sent in the months before Meggs and hundreds of others attacked the Capitol on January 6th. For example, December 19th, on Facebook, Meggs writes, quote, "Well, we are ready for the rioters. This week, I organized an alliance between Oath Keepers, Florida 3%ers, and Proud Boys. We have decided to work together to shut this expletive down," end quote. Rioters and an alliance. This is the first piece of evidence made public by investigators that point to possible coordination between extremist groups before their arrival in Washington. The messages continue. On December 22nd, Meggs told others he was going to Washington. He talked about President Trump, quote, "It's gonna be wild. It's gonna be wild. He wants us to make it wild. That's what he's saying. He called all of us to the Capitol and wants us to make it wild," end quote. Then, on December 26th, Meggs writes to an unidentified Facebook user, quote, "Wait for the 6th, when we were all in D.C., to insurrection," end quote. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today on Point, insurrection, investigation, and prosecution. What more do we know now about what happened on January 6th? We'll start today with Ryan Riley. He's senior justice reporter at HuffPost. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Meghna, thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit more about Kelly Meggs. Who is he?
Yeah, so Kelly Meggs is, as you said, a man from Florida who was sort of involved with coordination between these two groups. And sort of the, more broadly speaking, the incredible thing we've seen is just how much of this coordination took place on Facebook. And all of those messages, even private ones that are sent, are something that prosecutors, through a search warrant, are able to access. So we saw how this sort of played out in his case. But a lot of these other cases were just sort of out of the open public posts that people were making about the stolen election. And of course, Facebook is where so many of these myths about the stolen election took place, and people who were just convinced that, Joe Biden had been unlawfully elected and believed that they had to do something about it. And, as we look more broadly at the cases that are being brought forward, we're seeing sort of these two buckets, I think, of kinds of cases that the Justice Department is bringing forward. The Kelly Meggs case sort of falls into this one bucket of more organized action involving some of these groups like the 3%ers, like the Oath Keepers, like the Proud Boys, where we're going to be looking at pretty serious conspiracy charges. But there's this other bucket that is probably the majority of cases of people who we sort of refer to as MAGA tourists. And those are people who went either by themselves or with family members or close friends and sort of, ended up with sort of equivalent of a trespassing charge after sort of invading the Capitol. It's people, many times they don't have a criminal record before, but now are facing this federal investigation, which is just going to be life altering because they, took part in an insurrection and tried to stop the results of the 2020 election from being recognized.
Mm-hmm. Well, so a little bit more about Meggs, because in court documents filed by the government, they describe him as being seen in video recorded on the day of the insurrection, that Meggs was seen, quote, among a stack of more than a dozen individuals dressed in camouflage paramilitary gear, moving in a deliberate and organized manner towards the Capitol building. They also name another person the government is charged, co-defendant Jessica Watkins, who characterized the effort, according to the government, to breach the Capitol as, quote, forcing entry into the Capitol building, forced like rugby. Now, about Watkins, it's quite interesting because journalists have actually dug up some of the communications that that people were making on the day of the insurrection on January 6th. Micah Loewinger, a reporter and producer for the WNYC radio program On the Media, listened to walkie-talkie communications through the app Zello that were made on the day of the insurrection. And here is some of what he heard.
What kind of numbers do we have going to the Capitol? Any estimates? What percentage of the crowd is going to the Capitol?
100%. Everybody's marching on the Capitol, all million of us. It's insane. We're about two blocks away from it now, and police are doing nothing. They're not even trying to stop us at this point.
So On the Media identified that second voice as Jessica Watkins of Ohio, and she was indicted, as I mentioned last month, on four federal charges, including conspiracy. But Ryan, I think the thing that's really jumping out at folks this week is the government's pointing to these Facebook communications that you're talking about, where there it seems to suggest an alliance in advance of January 6th. I mean, what more do we know about that?
Yeah, there are definitely these alliances that, you know, that the government has now uncovered after arrest. And I think that's going to be the case in a lot of the in a number of cases where you have an initial arrest and the initial charges up front might be serious, but they might not be the full extent of the criminal culpability. And once they have access to that broader range of materials, often on the cell phones that are being seized from the defendants, they're going to add charges, and they're going to, you know, make this part of a broader conspiracy. What I would really note about that communication, which still sort of astonishes me, is there's this idea that the people who took part in the insurrection have that, you know, oh, Capitol Police aren't doing anything. And I mean, from the videos that we've seen, and just the sheer numbers of people who are coming in there, it's not clear that there's much more that the Capitol police could have done. You know, there was just an overwhelming crowd that mm-hmm. you can't stand up to that crowd. This was a catastrophe in terms of the preparation for this event. This was, I mean, probably one of the largest domestic, you know, intelligence failures in American history, to the failure to see this threat coming. But on that day, and, you know, now there's some Monday morning quarterbacking about what police should have done differently. And they obviously should have done a lot differently to prepare for this event. But you don't go to war with the, you know, the army you want. You go to war with the army you had, and the army that the government had that day was nowhere near ready to face this threat. So this idea that people are saying, oh, the police are just letting us do this, I mean, you couldn't execute an arrest that day just because of the sheer numbers. There was someone actually who was just recently charged, who actually was seized by police and was battling with police on January 6th, and they couldn't process his arrest, and they actually just had to snap a photo of his license. And then eventually, 2 months down the line, they got around to arresting him. And I think that sort of illustrates just sort of the overwhelming nature of January 6th and the idea that there was not the resources in place and not the ability in place to execute the number of arrests they really needed to take place. Because if, you know, kettling is a very controversial tactic, mm-hmm. but and that's the idea of when a group of protesters is seized and arrested en masse. And that's often been unfairly used and wrongfully used against protesters who did have the right to be on the street and were not acting unlawfully. In this case, anyone on Capitol grounds was acting unlawfully,
right.
Especially anyone inside the building was acting unlawfully. So if ever there was a reason to execute a kettle, this would have been it. But the manpower wasn't there. The backup wasn't there. And now because of that, we have a situation where they're having to go back and find these people who've now spread out all over the country.
Okay. So it seems, though, that in that effort, in finding those people, law enforcement, to a certain degree, is also overwhelmed, similarly or analogously overwhelmed, right? Because it is a massive undertaking. So last week, the FBI released 10 videos of assaults that took place against officers at the Capitol on January 6th. Assistant Director of the FBI's Washington Field Office, Stephen D'Antono, shared this message.
We need the help of the American people to continue bringing these criminals to justice. Tips from the public have contributed to the identification and arrest of multiple individuals for assaults on officers. Most recently, your tips helped identify two men involved in discharging a chemical agent that impacted U.S. Capitol Police and D.C. Metropolitan Police officers.
The two men referenced are Julian Cater and George Pierre Tanios, who were arrested on March 14th and charged with assaulting police officers. But Ryan, the FBI is still asking for tips. They've received hundreds of thousands of tips. Citizen sleuths, in a sense, are playing a role here.
Correct. And you know what's interesting, as the FBI continues to ask for tips to be sent in, what's happening with this sort of massive backlog of tips is that they're having trouble keeping up with the number of tips that are coming in. And often these things are just sort of lost in this sort of bureaucratic nightmare that you can imagine takes place when you're talking about a world of literally hundreds of thousands of tips from the public. I mean, just trying to sort through them is just a complete logistical nightmare. And we've seen some of the problems with that, in fact, in cases that we've reported. Last week, Robert Scott Palmer was arrested, and he was the man that Citizen Sleuths had labeled as a Florida flag jacket. And he was a man who went to the front of the police line wearing this star-spangled jacket with Trump on it, and actually used a fire extinguisher against police officers as they battled with this mob. Someone very quickly after the Capitol attack actually managed to track this person down and sent that tip to the FBI. It's someone we identified in our story as Amy. And what happened in this case is she basically gave the FBI this information, but there was not... But they had sort of sat on it for weeks until we reported. And it wasn't until after our story was reported that the FBI eventually made that arrest.
Interesting. So I was going to ask you about what came first, the HuffPost making the name public or the FBI having the tip. So thank you for answering that question in advance. Ryan Riley, stand by for just a second, because we're talking about what we've learned in the 2 months since the January 6th Capitol insurrection. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And this hour, we are talking about what more we've learned in the 2 months since the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol, specifically what we're learning through charging documents and court documents being filed against the hundreds of people thus far in association with the January 6th insurrection. I'm joined today by Ryan Riley, senior justice reporter at HuffPost. We've got links to Ryan's reporting at onpointradio.org. And I'd like to bring into the conversation now Mary McCord, legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection, and also visiting professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. Mary McCord, welcome to you.
Nice to be here, Meghna. Thank you.
So I want to get back to a little bit about where we started this show, the communications that the Justice Department has released that point to some degree of an alliance or coordination between paramilitary groups like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. I understand that you've been looking or had been following pre-January 6th communications. So how much do we know about how closely allied these groups were?
Well, I think we're learning more every day as the Department of Justice either, you know, brings new charges, returns superseding indictments, or in the case of the filing yesterday, makes court filings that describe in more detail the communications between the paramilitary organizations. Private researchers with whom my organization works, because we've been working to combat unlawful private paramilitary organizations ever since the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, back in 2017, private researchers were certainly tracking a lot of the planning and plotting and equipping of various organizations, and certainly knew in advance of January 6th and shared with law enforcement in advance of January 6th the fact that some people were planning on surrounding the Capitol, potentially overtaking the Capitol. Maps of the tunnels, were widely distributed online. But the extent of coordination between groups is still something that investigators are learning more about each day, and so are members of the public.
So are the is what the government has released in these documents, is it does it indicate to you a higher degree of coordination than otherwise might have been thought? I mean, there's been a lot of attention placed this week on the sections that I read out loud. How much coordination or of an alliance can we glean from what's been released?
Well, I think there's two different ways that there was coordination taking place, one very informal and the other potentially more formal. And the informal is that there was so much online chatter about January 6th in advance of January 6th, and different groups, and I'm not talking just about paramilitary organizations, mm-hmm. also conspiracy theorists, accelerationist groups, and violent extremists, as well as just a sort of a very pro Trump, MAGA population addicted to social media. All of these were sort of trafficking in propaganda and rhetoric about what could happen on January 6th. So certainly anyone who was planning to travel to Washington and wanting to do something to what it, in their view, was stop the steal, was certainly aware that many other people had a similar intent. So then the second question is, how coordinated were actual groups who were planning to act on that intent and use force against the Capitol to prevent the tabulation of the Electoral College votes? How many of those people coordinate together? And that's the part that I think is coming out in these charging documents. We've certainly seen, a conspiracy indictment, two separate superseding indictments against members of the Oath Keepers for their coordination leading up to and on January 6th. Mm-hmm. And we have separate conspiracy indictment with respect to the Proud Boys. And now, as you just indicated, we're starting to see documents filed in court that shows at least some type of alliance between these groups.
So it is fascinating what the communications reveal. I'm going to read another little section here from these documents. This is a series of messages on December 22nd that the government says Kelly Meigs discussed coordinating with the Proud Boys and members of the Oath Keepers who would be in Washington on January 6th. And the Facebook messages go back and forth. Looks like Meg says, nice, we will have at least 50 to 100 OK or Oath Keepers there. And then an unidentified person responds, hell yeah. Meg's responds, plus we have made contact with PB, meaning Proud Boys, and they always have a big group, force multiplier. Unidentified person says, yeah, they are showing in force. Meg says, I figure we could splinter off the main group of Proud Boys, or PB, and come up behind them, bleeping, crush them for good. Unidentified person says, good plan. Meg says, we can hang on for a while. They'll see one group, then we all fall to the back of the pack and peel off. We catch them in the middle. Game over. It almost sounds like tactical coordination, Mary.
That definitely is tactical coordination. Those are paramilitary techniques they're talking about. I do think that particular document you're quoting from, there are a couple of things going on here. There's planning about how to attack Antifa, what is perceived to be Antifa, because mm-hmm. as you may recall, there had been two previous demonstrations in November and December where the Proud Boys prominently got into street fights with counter protesters, people that they refer to as Antifa. So there was planning going on for that type of street violence on January 6th, as well as planning going on for some type of potential attack on the Capitol, depending on what Vice President Pence did with respect to the counting of the Electoral College votes.
Got it. Ryan Riley, do you want to jump in here more with what your reporting has found?
Yeah, I mean, what is also interesting with some of these cases of some of these extremists is how it's become such a popular thing to now fundraise for them on a lot of these right-wing websites. The Daily Beast had a story earlier this week about the sort of PR blitz that they've been on, and specifically with Kelly Meggs, there's a fundraiser for his family where they're sort of portrayed on one of these right-wing websites as this sympathetic family being subjected to government overreach, and that isn't really what matches up when you look at the actual conduct that is alleged here. But there's an audience out there that is now reading about Kelly Meggs and thinking that the government's really going after them unfairly, when that just doesn't match up with the reality of what that family's accused of doing.
Mm-hmm. Mary McCord, so one of the key questions here, and I'm not sure it is at all even approached in these court documents that we're seeing, is there may be evidence that points to coordination between groups like the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys and the Three Percenters. Is there any evidence emerging then that that coordination then, or that alliance then coordinated with the Trump campaign?
So I think, you know, that still remains to be seen. I haven't seen charging documents going that far. I think, you know, members of the public are very aware of the inciting comments made not only by former President Trump himself the morning of January 6th, but in the days and weeks and even months preceding it, and also by his surrogates, including people like Roger Stone. We have seen some links between Roger Stone and members of the Oath Keepers. And I think that what is probably happening right now, if I were still in government in the U.S. Attorney's Office or at the National Security Division, I would be looking for any types of links between those who were on the ground and those who were directing or coordinating or facilitating the efforts from afar, including potentially members of the Trump administration.
Mm. And when you mentioned still in government, I should be clear that you were acting Assistant Attorney General for National Security at the DOJ between 2016 and 2017. So help us understand more then what communications, again, these are all coming from the documents regarding Kelly Meggs' case, because they're just the freshest here, where apparently on Facebook, again, he writes that Insurrection Act should be why he is presenting to America. The he there, I believe he's referring to President now former President Trump. And he says, Pence announced that he's going to allow the evidence to be presented to Congress. That checks all the boxes. I think this is why we were called there. Anything less would be a terrible mistake. What do you make of that?
Well, this is in keeping with what we've seen some of the other people who've now been charged, and even some who haven't yet been charged, this is something that we were hearing from them, that they felt like they were actually called upon by President Trump to engage in this activity, and that they really thought they had his permission, you know, from his position with a veneer of credibility as the sitting president, telling them the very morning of January 6th, never give up, never concede, fight like hell. Many, you know, felt like that's our call. And this is the culmination of a series of back and forth call and response, you know, dog whistling that the president had with paramilitary groups over the past 4 years, and particularly the past year. We saw it when he, you know, approved of and called on them to liberate Michigan, liberate Minnesota, liberate Virginia in the face of governors, public health and safety orders, shutdown orders related to the pandemic. We saw it this summer when he called on, racial justice demonstrators violent anarchists and basically gave approval for paramilitary organizations to take to the streets and to, you know, fight against these quote unquote violent anarchists. So, and then we saw it obviously in the rhetoric about stop the steal in a rigged election, which was just really, again, dog whistling to them. So I think what you're seeing in the responses of some of those who participated in the insurrection is, you know, they definitely were doing this of their own free will, of course, mm-hmm. and their own organization because they felt strongly, but they also felt like they had the approval and the tacit, or not maybe not just tacit, but definitely the approval and encouragement of the president.
So let's step back here from Washington for a second, because in what you just said, it reminded me that prior to January 6th, right, we had We saw paramilitary groups sort of descend upon other state capitals, right? In Michigan, Oregon, yes. Just two examples. Now, you know, in terms of what we're learning about what happened on January 6th, is it all in keeping? It's all are these things all connected? I was going to say, oh, they're all connected. That's just like a ridiculous question. But what are you seeing now that helps us better understand the previous attacks on other state capitals?
Right. I think there's a through line there. You know, President Trump campaigned on a very anti-government platform, and that is very resonant with paramilitary organizations who have historically been very anti-government. And it sounds weird because, of course, the president was the president and the head of the executive branch of the government. But his mantra was to drain the swamp, and a very anti-government mantra. And he was, of course, very opposed to state governors who used their emergency authority to try to take measures to protect the public against the pandemic. And he aligned with paramilitary organizations and others who took the view that any type of public health measures were actually infringements on their civil liberties. And so that started this through line of acceptability to use violence and intimidation to try to influence the policy of government. And that first took place in the state houses, as we've just discussed, and then, you know, culminated with taking place at actually the U.S. Capitol in opposition to government's carrying out of the law. You know, it is the law that on January 6th, the joint session of Congress would meet to open and tally the Electoral College votes of the states. That's what they had an obligation to do, and that's what the insurrectionists attempted to thwart, and in fact did thwart it for, you know, 5 or 6 hours. Mm-hmm.
Ryan, let me turn back to you. I don't know if you want to comment on what Mary said or also, I mean, you've done some really interesting reporting on other arrests that have taken place in the past couple of weeks. So, I mean, talk about what Mary said, or I'm looking at your stories here about Thomas Sibnick, for example, who was arrested in Buffalo, New York.
Yeah, I mean, so with what Mary said, I think, you know, that was a really important point in terms of the messages that the former president was sending to his supporters. And if you look back even further, I covered this court case in Kansas involving three militia members who in the lead up to the 2016 election had plotted to slaughter a group of Muslim refugees, a community of Muslim refugees living in Kansas. And the messages that they were receiving from the president at that time were pretty clear that there was this invasion happening. And in fact, you know, they used some pretty disgusting language in talking about these people that they wanted to murder. And they were huge Trump fans. I mean, they were really the main person in this case thought that Donald Trump was the man, and they thought that they were reading all of these things on Facebook. And it was sort of this preview of what we've seen today, where they're getting hit with the social media misinformation, they're getting radicalized, and they're following the view of this charismatic leader and following Matt to the end. And, you know, the messages that they were receiving from Trump was pretty clear in the 2016 election, that there was this outside invasion and that he was the only person who could stop it. And that's what they sort of were acting on. And now when we've seen that followed in so many of these cases where, you know, every time a new case comes in, one of the first things I do is look at their social media presence and see what they still had online. A lot of these cases, they still have, you know, public postings about how they thought the election was stolen. You can sort of watch this radicalization process and the way that they're, you know, listening and ingesting these messages. And it doesn't, it's the logic sort of follows. If you honestly believed that the election was stolen, you, of course, are going to do something about that. And that's the thing about having millions of people who have deluded themselves into believing there is a stolen election, or have been deluded into believing there is a stolen election. That's the inherent danger here. When you have that many people who just believe this fundamental thing, that this is 1776 and that America is being stolen from them and that Joe Biden is an unlawful president, there's going to be a consequence to that. Some of those people are actually going to do something about it. And that's what we saw on January 6th. Mm.
But of course, I mean, this isn't, I'm not denying what you said, but belief does not justify criminal activity, right? So Mary McCord, we just got about 30 seconds to go here before the break. I want to move us towards talking about what charges the government is actually bringing, right? I mean, Thomas Caldwell, Jessica Watkins, Donovan Crowell, those are a couple of people who were indicted last month on those conspiracy charges to obstruct Congress's ability to verify the Electoral College votes. We've just, again, got 30 seconds before the break, Mary, but are those conspiracy charges adequate? Will the government be able to prove that? Do you think there's ample evidence for those charges?
Certainly, I think based on what we've seen in the speaking indictment, there's evidence sufficient to prove the currently, you know, charged crimes, including the conspiracy to obstruct the official proceeding. What remains to be seen is whether they'll develop evidence that would support even more serious charges. And I think that, again, that remains to be seen.
So we're going to talk about what those more serious charges may be when we come back. So Mary McCord and Ryan Riley, stand by. We're talking about what we have been learning in the 2 months since the January 6th attack on the Capitol. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow, we are going to talk about America's fragile drinking water infrastructure, fragile and aging. Remember when that big storm hit the South? We talked a lot about Texas's electricity grid. Well, in Mississippi, in Jackson, they went a month without clean drinking water due to that same set of storms. So we want to hear from you. Have you had to endure a boil water advisory where you live? Do you have confidence in the tap running clean whenever you turn it on? What do you think it's going to take to bring America's vital drinking water system up to snuff to make it resilient for the 21st century, especially in an era of more climate-induced wild weather? So call us with your experiences at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That is for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about what we've been learning in the 2 months since the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol, especially as is being revealed in court documents in the hundreds of cases that are currently being filed against people who participated on the riots on January 6th. Ryan Riley joins us. He's senior justice reporter at HuffPost. We have links to his reporting at onpointradio.org. Mary McCord is with us as well, legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection, also a visiting professor of law at Georgetown University. She was acting assistant attorney general, for national security at the DOJ from 2016 to 2017. So, Mary, let's get right to one of the big outstanding of the many, but the big outstanding legal questions here. And that is, we've been hearing over the past several days the possibility that the Justice Department is considering sedition charges against some of the folks who have been arrested. Now, the dictionary definition of sedition is, you know, roughly incitement of resistance to or insurrection against a lawful authority. How does that compare to what the legal definition in the United States of a seditious act would be?
Right. So the seditious conspiracy is actually the name of the crime, although that term is only used, and the term sedition is only used in the title of the criminal offense under the U.S. Code. And it describes actually quite particularly what is covered. And it in, And central to it, it is the conspiracy to use force. So to use force to overthrow, put down, or destroy the government of the U.S., to levy war against the U.S., or by force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law of the United States, or take or possess or seize any property of the U.S. So when you think about what we saw on January 6th, it doesn't have to be, in order to violate the seditious conspiracy statute, it wouldn't have to be a conspiracy to overthrow the entire government, for example, or levy war against the government. It could be by force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law of the U.S. And as we've been talking about, it is a law of the U.S. that the joint session of Congress must meet to tally the Electoral College votes of the states and certify the winner of the presidential election. And certainly just the reality of January 6th is force was used successfully to delay the execution of that law by about 6 hours. Mm.
So let's listen to what happened on Sunday, just this past Sunday, on 60 Minutes, on CBS's 60 Minutes, because former lead prosecutor Michael Sherwin talked about former President Trump and the role he may have played in the insurrection.
We have plenty of people. We have soccer moms from Ohio that were arrested saying, well, I did this because my president said I had to take back our house. That moves the needle towards that direction. Maybe the president is culpable for those actions. But also, you see in the public record, too, militia members saying, you know what? We did this because Trump just talks a big game. He's just all talk. We did what he wouldn't do.
In short, you have investigators looking into the president's role.
We have people looking at everything. Correct. Everything's being looked at.
So you heard CBS's Scott Pelley there. Michael Sherwin, again, the former lead prosecutor here, then went on to say that the DOJ may pursue seditious conspiracy charges.
I personally believe the evidence is trending towards that and probably meets those elements.
Do you anticipate sedition charges against some of these suspects?
I believe the facts do support those charges. And I think that as we go forward, more facts will support that, Scott.
And that's former lead prosecutor Michael Sherwin on 60 Minutes on Sunday. Mary McCord, this interview is causing a good deal of consternation within the DOJ. Why?
Well, what Michael Sherwin did as he's the former lead prosecutor because he was the Trump appointee as in the acting U.S. attorney position in the District of Columbia, which is the lead U.S. attorney's office doing this investigation, of course, in close coordination with the main Department of Justice. But he's still remaining a prosecutor. I think he went back to his original office in Florida. So as a current prosecutor, it's very problematic to speak publicly to the media, to the public about a current and ongoing investigation and particularly to predict potential charges. It risks, and of course, the judge in one of these cases immediately called the DOJ into an emergency hearing to discuss this because it risks the possibility of infringing on the defendant's rights to a fair trial. We don't try cases as prosecutors in the media. We try cases, say we, just because my former career for so many years as a prosecutor, of course, I'm not one anymore, but prosecutors try cases in court. And so there are internal Department of Justice guidelines that severely restrict speaking to the press about ongoing investigations. There are professional rules of responsibility that apply to lawyers about not making statements that could prejudice a case in trial. And then, of course, there's just the concern of the judge that in managing a case, he doesn't want to end up in a situation where the defendants are making an argument that they can't get a fair trial because there's been talk about the case in the press. So it's concerning that those statements were made, and that's why we're seeing the kerfuffle.
Okay, well, so some of our listeners want to know if the statements might actually hurt the investigation, the ongoing investigation into the Capitol riots. Do you think it could hurt or hinder them?
So I guess I'm less worried about them hurting the investigation in the sense that, you know, witnesses would not want to cooperate or they would reach dead ends. I guess it's possible that some witnesses might think this isn't fair. I'm not going to talk to you. That's certainly possible. My concerns are more that if there's too much talk about these types of charges, and then if the government doesn't end up actually charging those crimes, that the defendants will argue, you know, we're prejudiced because the former U.S. attorney made statements suggesting we were responsible for more serious crimes than we're even charged with, and we can't get a fair trial.
Ryan Riley, you're the senior justice reporter there at HuffPost. I mean, your thoughts about what's going on regarding even just the controversy over talking about possibly bringing seditious conspiracy charges?
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of something I've actually spoken to Mary about before, which is this idea that the United States doesn't have a domestic terrorism statute. And because of that, when we initially see a lot of these cases that are clearly terrorism, you know, just based on the evidence or colloquially could be referred to as terrorism, there's this frustration from the media when we see FBI and DOJ officials come out and not label something as terrorism. And, you know, this happens basically every time, you know, essentially, frankly, a white person or a white man kills a bunch of people in what clearly looks like a terrorist act. And we don't, law enforcement officials are always hesitant to say that up front because there's not really a domestic terrorism charge that they could bring. So if they were to say this is terrorism, that could cause these same sort of complications in a trial that we're now seeing play out here, when you get sort of outside of the bounds, the four corners of the indictment or the four corners of the criminal charges, so to speak. That causes problems in court, as we're seeing in this case.
Well, so to reiterate what we're talking about here, Mary, as you defined it, the federal criminal code defines seditious conspiracy as an effort by, has to be at least two or more people, to, quote, conspire to overthrow, put down, or destroy by force the government of the United States, or to levy war against them, or to oppose by force the authority thereof, or, again, by force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law of the United States, or by force to seize or possess any property of the United States contrary to the authority thereof. Now, interesting, because it seems, again, to the layperson, I guess to my lay eyes, a fairly specific definition, and yet the government rarely brings seditious conspiracy charges, and it's been more than two decades since prosecutors have successfully prosecuted the charge. So let's go back to 2010, which is the last time that the U.S. government even took up such charges. The case was against the far-right militia group, the Hatari in Michigan. Andy Arena was the head of the FBI's Detroit division at the time, and he says that case demonstrates just how hard it is to prove seditious conspiracy.
The government said that the Hutari militia was plotting to overthrow the government, and they said that the militia was going to kill a police
officer. They were an organization. They were meeting mostly on the weekends. They had uniforms. They had organization. They had structure. And they were really concerned about a lot of different conspiracies. Really, the kind of the focal point of their mistrust was FEMA. They were convinced that an old automotive plant near their base of operations, and it's going to be used as some type of like a concentration camp. There was a lot of mistrust of the government, particularly law enforcement. They were concerned the law enforcement was going to come and take them away. And so they started coming up with different plots to maybe kill a law enforcement officer, bring other law enforcement officers to a funeral, and then maybe attack them with an IED, a car bomb. From talking, it went to surveilling and it went to training, and it kept, you know, going down the steps towards actual action. I think in the mind of the prosecutors, they felt that they had gone far enough along that continuum that they had crossed over from First Amendment protected free speech to conspiracy.
In the end, the judge, federal judge Victoria Roberts, said there wasn't enough evidence to show that there was a concrete, firm plan, that it was anything more than just tough talk. Michael Meeks was one of the defendants. He has been incarcerated.
Prosecutors have to realize it's a very high bar that's been set. It's the First Amendment, right? Protected free speech is such a cherished right that we don't want to freeze that out, right? We don't want people to feel uneasy about what they're saying. Look, I think the founding fathers wanted us to question our government, right? Not to blindly follow, right? So we should have that right to question what they're doing. I think that raises that bar of seditious conspiracy.
That was Andy Arena, former head of the FBI's Detroit field office. He's now executive director of the Detroit Crime Commission and an adjunct professor at Western Michigan University School of Law. Mary McCord, just to be clear, as you heard Andy Arena say there, even after a couple of years in court in 2012, the members of this militia walked free. They were acquitted on those sedition and conspiracy charges. So what lesson do you think that last attempt a decade ago holds for prosecutors now?
So just to be clear, they weren't actually acquitted. The judge actually granted a motion for judgment of acquittal. So they weren't acquitted by a jury, I guess I should say.
Okay.
The judge ruled that the indictment, the charges, the government's evidence at trial had not proved the conspiracy because what it showed was First Amendment protected speech. And the judge was also concerned that the evidence in the judge's eyes had proved up something a little different at trial than what was alleged in an indictment. So there was another reason also for dismissing that case.
But isn't that in and of itself quite interesting? I appreciate your clarification,
yes.
But that the evidence, the judge was seeing that the evidence didn't match up with what prosecutors were alleging.
Right. And so the problem there is when you return an indictment and you make clear what you're charging a defendant with, the defendant then prepares for trial based on those allegations in the indictment. And so if there's some change, and in the judge's view, there was a change in the nature of the proof at trial, then a judge can say, well, that's unfair to the defendant, violates the defendant's due process rights because they weren't able to prepare for that. You've sort of switched up what you're trying to prove. And
okay.
That was of concern to the judge in that case. But I think one of the things to be clear that's different, I mean, yes, it is a challenging offense to prove. It's particularly challenging when the offense is never completed. And that was the case of the Hutaris, right? There was a conspiracy. And a conspiracy, to be clear, the charge of conspiracy itself is an inchoate crime, which means a crime that doesn't actually have to reach completion, because it is the nature of the agreement to violate the law, and in this case, the agreement to by force overthrow the government or prevent mm-hmm. or hinder or delay the execution of U.S. law, right? That's what seditious conspiracy is. So the agreement alone violates the law. But charging a case based on the agreement alone, when the parties didn't go ahead and undertake the by force action, is harder because then you are relying on statements, right? You're relying on an agreement and the prediction of whether that really means that speech is a speech to engage in force or violence.
Okay.
Now,
I was just going to say here, we just got a minute left to go, Mary, but so I'm listening to what you're saying and thinking about what happened on January 6th. We started this conversation about talking about the planning, the alliances, et cetera, revealed in pre-January 6th communications. Then we had the actions itself. So
exactly.
What more would prosecutors need to feel confident to bring the seditious conspiracy charges?
I think they have to feel confident that there is that agreement, right? That people had a common purpose to actually use force to prevent a delay the execution of law, and that it didn't just happen spontaneously. Because yes, we saw it happen. It definitely, they used force to prevent and delay the execution of U.S. law. So it's about proving that agreement now.
Well, we'll have to see what happens in the coming days, weeks, and months. So Mary McCord, legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection, and she was also acting assistant attorney general for national security at the DOJ from 2016 to 2017. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
And Ryan Riley, senior justice reporter at HuffPost. Ryan, thank you for joining us, and thank you for your reporting on this ongoing momentous part of U.S. history. Thank you, Ryan.
No problem. Thanks so much for having me.
And by the way, we've got links to Ryan's reporting at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.